This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols, and you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. This episode is sponsored by a company I've literally been using for over 15 years now, and that is 5.11. Now, my introduction to their products began when I started wearing 5.11 uniforms years ago for Anaheim Fire Department, and since then I have acquired a host of their backpacks and luggage, which have literally been around the world with me. The backpack where I keep all my recording equipment is a 5.11 backpack, and then most of my civilian gear, the clothes that I wear, are also 5.11. Now, more recently, they've actually branched out into the brick and mortar stores. So, for example, Gainesville, where I do jiu-jitsu, has a beautiful 5.11 store. So if you are a fire department, a law enforcement agency, you now have access to an entire inventory of clothing and equipment in these 5.11 stores. Now, I've talked about the range of shoes they have and how important minimizing weight in our footwear is when it comes to our back health, knee health, etc. I've talked about their unique uniforms that are fitted for either male or female first responders. And then I want to highlight one new area, their CloudStrike packs. For those of you who enjoy hiking, this would even be an application, I believe, for the wildland community. They've created an ultralight pack now with a hydration system built in for rucking, running, or other long-distance events. Now, as always, 5.11 is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off every purchase that you make. So if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, at 5.11tactical.com, you will get that 15% off every single time. So if you want to hear more about 5.11 and their origin story, go to episode 338 of Behind the Shield podcast with their CEO, Francisco Morales. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show British military veteran Darren Palatina. So we discuss a host of topics, from his journey into the military, the mental health impact of service, the mission he's on now to help heal veterans and first responders, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Darren Palatina. Enjoy. Well, Darren, I want to start by saying thank you so much to Tim Lloyd for connecting us and to you for coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No, I appreciate it, James. Cheers.
So first question, where on planet Earth are we finding you?
Shrewsbury, so UK, United Kingdom, a place called Shrewsbury. I'm just outside of Shrewsbury, a place called Oswestry. It's a small market town about 10 miles outside of Shrewsbury. So it's, it's a nice little town.
Brilliant. Well, I want to start at the very beginning of your lifeline. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Right. So I was born in Shrewsbury. I've done a complete round the world cycle back to Shrewsbury. So I was actually born in Shrewsbury town. There used to be a hospital here. Born in 1984 in November. I got a dad who is in construction. He's been a builder for bloody hell, I don't know how many years, like 45 years or something like that. He's been in construction, building, originally a carpenter joiner, but he later on in his sort of construction career became a property developer. So now he owns a big property development company in the UK. So mum and dad are divorced. They divorced when I was 11. And then my mum, she used to do nursing. Then she went into, she trained to be a dental assistant and then was going down the dental route. And then she's come back into nursing now as the head of the nursing district. So she's like top management for the county now. So mum has remarried, currently going through a divorce now after like 11 years, I think it is. My dad has got a girlfriend, long-term girlfriend. We get on really well with her and they're good with my daughter as well. On my mum's relationship side, we get on well with him, like not amazingly well, but we get on, you know, we're friendly enough. But obviously with the divorce and that now going on, we sort of try to keep out of the way, let it all do its own thing and whatever they need to sort out. So and then from that, from my biological mum and dad, I've got a sister. She is bloody hell, what is she now? She'd be 36 37. She's got a little one, a little one, he's like 12 now, 12-year-old kid. And then I've got a stepbrother who is my mum and an old boyfriend of hers from years ago. So we all get on with that side, that, you know, they're all really well and they all still get on. So that part of the family sort of still together, but mum and dad's the mum and dad relationship of that part are separated. So, and then that's it for the actual family. Then obviously me, my girlfriend, my three-year-old daughter. That's my now immediate family now, if you like. So we all live together in a small apartment. So it's all good.
And when you were at school age, what were you playing as far as sports back then?
I bunked off school. I was an absolute rebel in school, right? So when I was in school, I used to race motocross. I was seventh in the UK Nationals for motocross. I used to just love BMXing, dirt jumping, motocross, anything I could get my hands on. It was dirt and wheels. And whenever I used to go to school, I always used to get out of school as early as possible, normally before school started. And I'd always end up on the bike tracks, running my bikes and that while mum and dad were at work, so I couldn't get caught. Had a couple of police chases back then where they were trying to get me off the land and, you know, like I said, a proper rebel. I was in a punk band for 9 years when I was younger. I used to have bright pink hair, piercings. It was a fun childhood into teenage years, we'll say that, you know. And in terms of school, I left school with no GCSEs, no qualifications, just had nothing, you know, but I enjoyed it, had fun.
Back when you were little, was it still the case where at 15 you could have a 49.5cc motorbike? I remember there was a couple of kids in my senior year that turned, I guess maybe it was 16. It must have been 16. And they were the cool kids because they had these little tiny bikes.
Yeah. So legally for road, you have to be, was it 16? 16, 17. And you get what's called a CBT. It's like a learner license, if you like. And then you can ride I think you can ride up to a 125, but it has to be restricted. And then depend on your age. I can't remember. I've got my bike license, but it's a full bike license now. So it's been probably 9 years since I passed that. So I can't quite remember what the rules are with like young riders now.
Interesting. Yeah. I remember there was one friend, actually, he passed away since he had a car accident, single car accident, and it's probably the first person that wasn't extremely elderly that I know that died at a very young age. But I remember, yeah, there was some sort of restriction where you could do up to 50 cc's when you were 16, I think, back then at least. This is probably a while ago now.
Yeah. See, well, if you go really far back, like granddad writes, it's you didn't even have to have a license for a car back then. It's just like take a little lap around the course, and it's like, yeah, it's your license done. Yeah, so yeah, it's things have changed a lot, haven't they? So
they have indeed. Well, what about punk? I've had from the US side, I've had a lot of people talk to me about their journey through punk, and a lot of them were what they called straight edge. So they didn't drink. I mean, it was the hardcore music, but they weren't into the kind of self-abuse that some of the punks that I witnessed growing up were, you know, sitting in a bus stop drinking cider all day. So what kind of genre of punk or community did you find yourself immersed in?
So we were pop punk, so very sort of upbeat. I wouldn't say like Sum 41, but kind of more towards Green Day type style, but with our own sort of spin on it. I came from a self-taught background of bass, so I played bass. And my favourite bands, well, my favourite band learning, the two bands were actually Jamiroquai and Red Hot Chili Peppers. So I was a very sort of slap bass, funky kind of bass player. That's my kind of style. But my vocalist and guitarist, both one person, they were like proper hardcore punk. Then the drummer came from a metal background, so we had like a proper mashup. But yeah, it was like the punk style. Obviously, the drums blend into that as you know, with the beat. You know, the beats that you use within punk. And then I just put the funk bass to that, and it used to work really well, you know. So I'll send you a link to our old album. We did an 11-track album while we were touring, so it was good. Brilliant. I'll send it at some point. You can have a listen.
And what about the scene? The kind of people that you had were, you know, was it a you know, a violent concert, or was it pretty chill, as I would imagine a Jamiroquai based
it varied. Music would it be. Varied. Like music. We used to play in some pubs that would have like, you know, 50 or 60 turnout, and we had a couple of gigs which are over 10,000, you know, so it depends what side you're looking at. Like sometimes we have really local gigs in local pubs, which we had a close following that were always well behaved because they didn't want to ruin it for us. But then when you get to like the bigger ones, you got like proper mosh pits, people headbutting each other. It was just like carnage. So, yeah, it completely ranged across the whole lot, you know. So, yeah, it was interesting, you know, especially we went all around UK, from all the way from Scotland right down to, you know, Brighton and Cornwall as well, you know. So we did a lot of gigs local. We had a couple in Europe. I can't remember where we played in Europe. In Germany and France we played a few gigs, but I can't remember what the pubs were called now, or the places. But yeah, it was good in terms of gigs. We were a good band, you know, for punk. I know some people who don't like punk, they'll say, well, punk will never be good, but you know, we were a good band. In terms of the scene, the friend scene, I was into drugs, heavily into drugs, like a lot, you know. And I used to do, you know, people say, oh, when they think drugs, they think cannabis. It's like, no, we were doing speed, ecstasy, MDMA, you know. I got spiked with heroin twice, cocaine. You know, I really went around the mill with that, and that was part of the reason, we'll discuss it later, why I joined the army, because I really wanted to get away from it after 9 years of battering myself, you know. So it got to a point where I just had enough, wanted out, and yeah, that was it.
When the mental health conversation comes into the uniform professions, there is a danger of just focusing on what we did or what we saw as the kind of root cause for some of our challenges. As I've matured, learning through this podcast and hearing so many stories now, the importance of the formative years into our foundation later on was very clear. When you look back now, and obviously we're going to get into some of your mental health journey, were there elements of your childhood you think that contributed to some of the drug use and, you know, other things that you were doing growing up?
Yeah, so I'm actually going through hypnotherapy at the moment. We did discuss this on the first session, and it went all the way back. So when I was younger and mum and dad were still together, we had a really big house up the road, literally within walking distance. My nan and granddad lived there, my auntie and uncle, all motocrossers, they all like racing. We all meet up on weekends. We had the track at my nan's house because they owned a farm. You know, at like 10 years old, we used to run around with like air rifles and machetes in the countryside, just like hunting pheasants and whatever we could, you know, to earn a bit of pocket money. We'd go hunting pheasants, sell them to the locals. It probably weren't even our pheasants, but you know, probably illegal at the time. But you know, that's what we used to do as kids. But then when mum and dad divorced, obviously we couldn't afford to keep, my dad had moved to town, which was probably I want to say about 25 miles away from home. And then my mum was left in this massive house. It was like a 6-bedroom. It was huge. My dad built it, you know, big construction company. He built this house, but we couldn't afford to keep running it. So my mum ended up having to sell the house. Then we moved into a town, Oswestry, which is where I live now. And I think having all that childhood experience ripped away like that, you know, not being able to ride my bike in the countryside, not being able to go hunting, not being able to build tree houses, that had a negative effect. And then obviously soon after that, dad had a new girlfriend, mum had a new boyfriend. They both resented us being around. So they didn't want, you know, if I go to my dad's for the weekend, my dad's girlfriend didn't want us there because she had two kids, and go to my mum's, and mum's boyfriend didn't want us around. So it was like rejection from both sides. And during the time in the band, like my sister, I've never spoke to my sister about it actually, what situation she was in, because her and my mum's boyfriend were always in fights, like all the time, constantly. But I think I joined the band, and it wasn't for about 2 years after being in the band is when the drugs started. But obviously all this story led into us moving to this town, meeting the wrong crowd, getting into band. I didn't play bass before I moved to town. And then I ended up having like massive fights with my mum, who we were living with at the time. And I ended up leaving. I got kicked out at like 17. And then I ended up living on a lot of friends' floors. We had a practice room, you know, a couple of years later, we had a practice room where we'd play, and we just set up a sofa there. I'd sleep in the practice room, you know, get food in and stuff like that, you know. So it probably had quite a massive impact. But it's not, you know, what we discussed in the hypnotherapy, like after, you know, when we talk about the whole story later, although that was a massive impact at the time, it's definitely not what's impacting now, you know. So it's kind of like, you know, water under the bridge as such now. You know, they've all got new partners, we all get on right, and it's kind of all worked out okay.
Excellent. Yeah, it's an important part of discussion, though, and it can be, you know, something horrendous like growing up around sexual abuse, or it can just be, and I think this is a very powerful negative element, just feeling not good enough for, whether it's, you know, someone who gave you up for adoption, whether it's, you know, not getting the attention from a parent now because a step parent is in, you know, in the picture. And I'm acutely aware of that as a step parent myself, you know, making sure that, you know, I'm present with my stepson, present with my son's son, you know, and of course there's a dynamic, because when you're, you know, whether it's your step or your original spouse, you know, there is a time sharing when you have children and a loved one. So, but that feeling of rejection, not feeling safe, not feeling loved, you know, is extremely detrimental to a young child.
Yeah. Now I can imagine, like, you know, situations that, I've spoke to a couple of people for my channel, and they've really gone through the mill, like, you know, with domestic violence, fathers and all sorts, like. So yeah, it's you know, with my childhood coming up, it's quite mellow compared to some. You know, we just had divorced parents, and you know, the lifestyle change, really. Effectively, that was it. You know, there wasn't any violence. There's no domestic abuse or anything, or sexual abuse or anything like that, you know. So, you know, to most, it's quite light. And it's probably quite normal, I would have thought, to quite a lot of families.
Yeah. Yeah. But they say don't compare trauma, though, and I agree with that. You know, just because it wasn't horrific doesn't mean it didn't have an impact. And sadly, I think there's a lot of – it's common, but it's not natural to be born with two parents, and all of a sudden you're living in different houses every other day. And I mean, it is what it is, but yeah, it's still abnormal.
And I suppose, like, at the time, it was traumatic at the time, because it's probably the most traumatic thing you've experienced until later on. So, you know, when you compare your trauma later on in life, you look at that and think, oh, it wasn't so bad, but at the time it was everything. So
exactly, it's what you knew, it was your whole world.
Yeah.
So what about career aspirations? You ended up in the military. Was that what you were dreaming of in school?
No. So I always had an interest in drawing. I love drawing. And I wanted to be an architect. And with my rebellious nature in school, and I found out after finding that he'd have to go to college for 5 years to become an architect, I was like, there's no way I'm doing that. I didn't like school, never mind going to college for another 5 years. So I didn't do that. And then I just kind of milled about for quite some time. I had some work with my dad as a labourer. Later on became a tiler and flooring specialist. And then moving into like bathroom fitting and kitchen fitting and things like that, you know, doing all the aesthetics of it, you know, with the tiles and flooring. So I did that for 8 years, 8 or 9 years. And at the same time as doing that, I was obviously in the band, doing the drugs, in the wrong crowd, you know, not really going anywhere. And it's just it kind of felt like a bit of a dead end. You're just doing this job for like, this is the rest of my life type thing. So, but something I always wanted to do, for so long, for 15 years, was do graphic design. I had an interest in graphic design for many, many years, and I put it off, and you know, for years, and then the military happened and stuff like that, and you know, we'll talk about it later, but I didn't actually take the leap into graphic design until January 2022. So it was like 15 years that I had held off, you know. So, but that's obviously later on down the road, like, you know. So yeah, so after the labouring, there was no real career aspirations. I just needed to get away, you know, from the situation. Like with the drug abuse, it was causing like kidney problems, and I used to have really bad dermatitis on my hands, and it turned out that the drugs were causing bad circulation to the skin, you know. And I found that out purely by off chance, because I had a week off drugs, and over that week my hands were getting better, like rapidly getting better. And I didn't understand what it was. And then one night I went out, took some ecstasy, a couple of pills, and it was like literally the next morning my hands were back as they were, you know, like really bad again. So that's when it clicked. And I was like, yeah, the drugs are doing, that's what's doing the damage. So I was like, I need to get out of this. And I tried to get out a few times, you know, but with it being a small town, you kept getting pulled back in. And eventually at 22, I was like, no, I'm done. I'm getting in the army. I'm going. So I at that time, my mum had moved back into the countryside. This is some years later. I know it's jumping all over the place, this is, but my mum had moved back into the countryside, and I was like, Mum, I'm going to come and live with you for 6 months, get away from town, and then get to the point where I'm just going to run every day, hydrate, eat healthy, and I'm going to just apply to the army. And that's what I did, you know, in 2007 to get away from everything.
And which area within the military did you find yourself?
So I originally joined, so when I first joined, I joined the infantry under the Welsh Guards, and I think it was 9 or 10 weeks in, I ruptured or tore my cartilage in my left knee, and that put me down into holdover, which is obviously like a recovery holdover within the training unit. And while I was sitting in there, I was like, I don't really want to do infantry. I think I've just sort of jumped in, because when I went into because I was trying to get away so much, what had happened, I went into the careers office and was like, what is the fastest way to get in the army? I don't care who it's with, where it's at, what is the fastest way to just get in? They're like, the infantry, you can go in 3 weeks as long as you pass the medical. So within 3 weeks, I was going into training up in Catrick in North Yorkshire. And when I got there, I was just like, nah, I'm not, if I did 20 years as infantry, I'm going to come out with all this weapon training that I'm never going to be able to use on the way out. So when I got injured, it gave me time to think about, you know, what do I really want to do? And because I was always already in construction, one of the things that made sense was the Royal Engineers. So they do, obviously, engineering, bridging, explosives, all that kind of stuff, as well as soldering, but you also get a trade. So you can be electrician, plumber, bricklayer, anything like that, because they go away and do construction tours, which is one of the tours we did later on. But I decided in holdover that I was going to pull myself out of training, so you can PVR, which is like an early release. I did that, and about 4 or 5 months later, I reapplied. I said, look, my knee's all better. I had to go through like checks and medical checks and stuff like that with the knee. I was running at the time, then I got my running up to, you know, 10 mile runs and stuff. So my fitness was getting even better anyway. And then, I decided to sign up for the Royal Engineers, and that's where I stayed then at that point.
So describe what the role looked like, because you got in 07, 08, is that right?
08. Yeah, 2007, yeah. Yeah.
So what did that role look like? And then what was the kind of combat landscape that you were dealing with?
Right, so when I first, obviously I went through training, so I went in, obviously when you go into Royal Engineers, everybody does infantry training, everybody does, as a Royal Engineer, everyone does the same basic training, which is your soldier training. Then you do the combat engineers course, which is bridging, water supply, mine warfare, you know, from minefield clearance and stuff like that. So everybody go through that. Then at the end of that, you then all break up and go your own way to your own chosen career path. So some might be radio operatives, some might be, you know, plant operatives, you know, like diggers and all that sort of stuff. Some might go into more of a logistic role or construction role, whatever you do that way. So I chose to go in as what's called a building and structural finisher, a BNSF. And that specialised in, again, like tiling, flooring, all the cosmetics of building. So painting, decorating, glazing, airless spraying, all that. Anything you see as a finished touch within construction, that's what a building and structural finisher does. So I'd already had like 8.5 years experience in construction, working, you know, hands-on every day doing this job anyway. And when I'd got in, so I'd already gone through training, and just before going into training, I'd actually met a girl who I later married. We got married together. She was a nurse in the army. And I got through training, and as soon as I got to my unit, I did 3 months on the front gate as guard. So you do like cycles of guard duty on the front gate. And then after that, I got posted out to Oman to do a construction tour. The unit was already out there, but obviously you go to your unit, do 3 months on guard, and then get deployed wherever. But I came out of my course with a 98% score, which is the highest score since like the 1940s, I think it was, for the course of building a structural finisher. I think that was purely down to the amount of experience I got, where everyone else that was coming in was quite fresh to the job. But when I was going through there, we were due to get married towards the end of my course, and I was like, look, I need to get out this course early because my wedding's going to be coming up pretty close after the course. And I said to my instructor, you know, if I can finish this, you know, the final test, it was like a 6 month course, and the final exam was like 4 weeks. I said, if I can finish this in a week or 2 weeks, can I get let off to go and do the wedding? And he's like, nobody's ever finished within 2 weeks. Nobody's ever finished a course within 2 weeks and got a decent mark. And I got 98% within 7 days, 7 working days. So I absolutely smashed it out. And the only thing that let me down on that was like a little scuff on one of the tiles, and that was it. Otherwise, it was flawless. So they were like absolutely gobsmacked, couldn't believe it, let me go early. I went and got married. And then after that, my then wife got deployed to Afghanistan as a frontline medic. She got injured. Her vehicle went over an ID, killed the two lads in the front and broke her back. She got PTSD as well. I didn't understand PTSD at the time. So when she came back, she was a mess, and, you know, things weren't working. We got really rocky. And then it was a case of, you know, we separated, and then that later led to a divorce down the line. But when I came off my course, went to my unit, then I straight away after 3 months on guard, I got deployed to Oman, and I got put in charge of a team there because they knew my experience coming through. I'd already had a lot of experience within construction. That was... I think the worst days we had were like 90, I remember 96% humidity and about 68 degrees, like Celsius. So it was hot as hell, but humid as hell. And we were, you know, once the block work had gone up, our job was to go into these rooms and deck them all out. And what we were doing was building an RAF base on this construction tour for the Air Force. And we'd be in the bay, and literally you'd start at like 7:30 in the morning, you'd do an 18-hour days, like, you know, getting absolutely ragged. And you'd be, you'd get into the bay, and within 15 minutes you can wring your t-shirt. You were just drenched from like top to bottom. And that was like all day. If you go and get a new t-shirt on, it's pointless. You come back and you're soaking. It's part of it was sweat, but a lot of it was the humidity of Oman. So that was a hard tour, and that really separates the men from the boys, because you're doing 18 hours, extreme heat, extreme humidity, you know, there's camel spiders everywhere. Them things are horrible things, like, you know, they're bloody dangerous as well. But we used to have men going down all the time, left, right and center, with heat stroke, dehydration, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So that went on for I think I was there for 5 or 6 months, and then back to my unit for obviously back home, back to my unit. And then shortly after that, I started up, I was the one that started the Royal Engineers Downhill mountain bike team. They had mountain bikers, but they never actually formed a team. So I put the team together. And then the warrant officer, me and him were really good friends, even though I was like at the time a private and he was warrant officer. So it's a big gap between the ranks. But me and him got on really well because he was a keen mountain biker. I was into downhill mountain biking. Put the team together, started racing, competing in that as well. So that was good. And then I was always like an adrenaline junkie. Bear in mind, I've done motocross, downhill mountain biking, BMX, in dirt jumping, everything you can, all the drugs. It's all like adrenaline and that high. There was a couple of friends, two other guys in my squadron that did downhill mountain biking as well. And we ended up going to race the Mega Avalanche in France, which is a 30-kilometer downhill event. It's crazy. It's nuts. It's all snow, ice, and then mud. But when we all got called out, we knew Afghan was coming up, Afghanistan, so Herrick 15, which was 2011. And we all got called outside and they said, look, we've been called up. We've got to go on deployment. And this would have been like 2010, beginning of 2010, where we got the notice. And they said they want to, we're going to be re-rolling into IED search team. So like improvised explosive devices, basically bombs, IED search team and bomb disposal. So we were going to retrain as engineers. Bear in mind, we already do like mine warfare and stuff like that. So it's quite a natural progression. So they said we want volunteers first rather than, they call it dicking, but like we're going to volunteer you essentially. They call it dicking, but rather than dick you for it, we want volunteers first. And I was like, I'll have some of that. Boom, hand went straight up. And I was like, this is going to be awesome. I looked down the line of 48 men and there's only two other hands up. And it was my two mountain bike friends because they're adrenaline junkies. So it's three of us all ready for the buzz. And after that, then, other people start coming forward, reluctantly come forward because it's a big risk. You're going out there to find bombs and disarm them. So then that led to like 18 months training for Afghan. And then we went out there. Eventually we went out. So there's loads of teams. I think there's like, we were 48. So there'd be about 50, 52 teams that were out there at any one time. And they're like 10-man teams. So, there's a large amount. Not all Royal Engineers teams. Some are like all cat badge teams, multi-cat badge. But yeah, we ended up training for 18 months, which ended up going to Jordan, we're like Petra around that area for like... like environmental training to get used to like the heat, the humidity, the dryness, the desert, all that stuff while you're doing the training. And then, shortly after that, we went out to Afghan. So as a bomb disposal unit, and that was kind of it. But, rewind a little bit, 2010, when all the training was going on, we actually did 10 marathons in 5 days. So we did a charity event, as well as all this extra training. And we went from Sheffield to Brighton, which is it's about 260 miles. But we went via London. So it was for St. Dunstan's charity for blind ex-servicemen. And then we did that, 10 marathons, two marathons a day for 5 days, carrying 40 pound Bergen. So that was good as well to add to the pre-deployment training, because you just get used to carrying the weight. And then, we went out to Afghan to ready for the tour. So that's kind of, I know that was a long story that was, but.
No, it's just good though. I mean, it's just what happened. So up to that point, had you witnessed much as far as, a kind of true combat zone, or because as you meant Oman and some of these places, have you been kept away from it?
Not really. No, it was pretty chilled out, to be honest. Like it was hard graft. Like, don't get me wrong. It wasn't easy. Like construction tour was a killer. Every day it was a killer. Even Jordan, like you're doing 12 to 15 hour days there. And if you finish your job early, your training exercise early of like clearing a compound or clearing a route or whatever it be. If it was another team that was still behind on time, you'd then be called out to go to them and go and help them out and help them clear the route quicker. And, so you think you're going to get the rest of the day to chill out, and it's like no chance, other jobs to do, And it's the same with Afghan, all they do is they replicate what's going to go on tour, so. But in terms of, there was no combat, there was no, we had a couple of guys that, there was a guy that got crushed. We were on a bridging exercise and he got crushed by two of the panels, broke a load of ribs. But, that was just like a an injury. He didn't die. It wasn't, there was no blood. It was just internal bruising, broken ribs. I can't remember if he had any lung damage, but you know, these panels are, you know, the big, big bridging panels, they get lifted in by a crane. But that didn't cause any trauma. It was just like, as an injury, send him off, you'll be all right. You know, so other than that, yeah, nothing really like.
So contrast that with Afghanistan. Walk me through when you first arrived and then, you know, some of the notable incidents that you'd had.
Bloody hell. Right, so I went out. So essentially all the teams go out different. And in my squadron, I think there's like 6 or 7 teams in my squadron. A lot of lads that we knew. And the team that I was on, and there was another team. So the other team, there was 2 guys in that team that they were like best mates. They were always gobby, always joking around. You know, they got separated because they were due to get injured. They might have got injured because of like the messing about all the time. And I got moved to the other team. I think I got moved to the other, I can't remember how it went, but I think I got moved to, we swapped teams, me and this one lad, Dom. And he went out. We all went out to Afghan together, but I was part of a training team initially for the first like 4 weeks. So I was training. I went out early because we were training people like on like ground sign awareness and, you know, like tracking and looking for like signs that things have been buried and that sort of stuff. And then while I was in that training team, I was in a position of what's called a battlefield casualty replacement. So if anyone gets injured, they'd ship me out there to replace them on the team so the team can still operate. And Dom, who was in my, who I replaced, we swapped roles or teams, their team was out on the ground. And within the first 2 weeks, he lost his right leg, or he stepped on a device which basically smashed the bottom of his leg apart. And it was all in his boot, mangled up in his boot. He ended up getting it amputated from the knee down. And that was within 2 weeks. And when you're in Camp Bastion, which is the main base, and then you've got Leatherneck, which is the US base attached to it. When people get injured, they go into, what is it now? Op Minimize, I think they called it. Op Minimize, which is where they shut the communications down until the family of that injured soldier is notified, so people aren't on Facebook and, you know, gobbing off about it before the family have been told. So when you're in Bastion, you start to realise how many people are getting injured, because every day, op minimise is down, op minimise, and as soon as it comes off within an hour, op minimise again. So you know that there's people on the ground constantly getting hit somewhere, whether it's infantry being shot, people getting stepped on IEDs, or whatever it be, there's a massive range of injuries that take place. You know, even if someone just falls over and breaks their leg, it's classed as an injury, so they have to go op minimise until everyone's been notified. But we were just, I remember being in the tent at night and you'd hear op minimise coming in. Oh, am I going to get called out now? Am I going out on the ground? Who, you know, when is it my turn type thing? And it gets more and more scary. It's kind of like anticipating that drop on a roller coaster. You know it's coming, but you don't know when it's going to come, you know, and you know your time is going to come at some point. You just hear all these injuries coming in. And eventually, Dom got hit. And like, I've got the story of how that all took place as well, but I got called out to replace Dom, and it was just lucky for me that I'd landed in a team that I knew the guys. You know, I was already used to working with them. Now some of the other lads in my squadron, they got posted to teams that we'd never even met. We didn't know any of them. So not only are you joining a team you don't know, but them guys have just been through hell, like potentially with a friend killed or injured, that they've had to get off the ground. So they're already in a bit of a highly battered state, and then you're a new person they don't even know joining the team to replace that person. It's a bit morbid in a way, but you know, the operations have to keep going, you know, you've got stuff to do, like, you know. So but yeah, so if we go through the whole deployment of Afghan, so you know, we had other friends which were killed, injured. You know, Jimmy, he lost both legs on another team. We had Ryan. So Ryan was one of our close friends. He got a reading on the search equipment, you know, the equipment we used to find the IEDs under the ground. And when you search and you get something, you call back to get everyone to stop and to stop coming closer, because you're going to try and go down. And what they do is call it confirming. So you lay down and you dig in from the side in case it's a pressure release pad. You dig in from the side to make sure, to try and confirm what that device is. And Ryan had got a reading, and he called back. He said, "Oh, you know, hang on, I've got something here." And when you turn back, you're meant to search again to confirm exactly where that reading was before you get down to dig, because you don't know where it is. You know, you might have stepped forward a little bit or back or whatever. But he didn't do that. And what he did, he put his equipment down and he went down on his elbows to try and confirm where he thought he got the reading. And he dug down, there was nothing there. And he said, "Oh, I've got nothing." So when he went to get back up, what he'd actually done is put his elbows across the pressure plate. So it was sitting between his elbows and his chest. And when he went to get back up, he put his hand down on it and it blew up and it broke ribs and, you know, smashed him to bits. But it didn't kill him, but he was, you know, in a bad way, like. And that was one injury, one of our friends that got injured. Then another one we had, there was a guy called Rifleman James Steele. He was part of the Rifles. I can't remember if it was three or four. I think it was four Rifles. And we got called out to a job. And as an IED search team, part of our job is if a device goes off, we have to go out and investigate. We want to get intelligence to figure out the explosive size, what kind of detonation device was used, whether it be banjo strings, pressure plate, light, you know, sensitive or command wire or whatever it be. We have to go and get all that information to figure out. But unfortunately, part of the job is also recovering any parts. So that's body parts, rifle, any equipment, and stuff like that. But this guy, he had stepped on a device coming back to their patrol base, and the blast had taken both his legs out at the hip. So from the hip down, it was just gone. And his team had managed to get him on the helicopter alive, but obviously tourniqueted his waist to just try and stop him bleeding out. He was alive, but obviously semi in and out of consciousness when they picked him up on the helicopter. But when we were going out to investigate, we got told that he died on the way to Bastion on the flight, but his team hadn't been told because obviously they were still on the ground keeping an eye out on, you know, nobody else coming into the area to plant any more devices. So when we were there, we were told that we cannot tell their teammates anything that we know in terms of what's gone on with James, because, you know, they've got to keep their heads together. So we did our normal job. We did a, you know, the isolation, which is you loop around the area to make sure there's no wires going into it. And if there are, you cut those wires with like a detonator. And that gets rid of one threat. And then you've got like radio operated devices, you know, with a phone and stuff like that. You've got ECM on your back, which is, it's designed to scramble that signal. So they can't set anything else off with that. Then the only other threat then you've got is, you know, pressure plates that you can step on. So obviously with that, you've got search equipment that you've got to try and find stuff. So anyway, we got to the blast point and we were doing the isolation around the blast point. I found another wire. Well, I found a wire and I was on a bit of equipment called a Goldie, and the Goldie is designed to find cables under the ground. And I got a read and I said, I got a read near, and it was quite close to the blast area. And my section commander said, "Oh yeah, it's probably the wire to the device that's gone off." And I was like, getting an idea of where this, you know, under the ground, trying to figure out where's this wire going, trying to reach as far as I could without stepping outside the search lane. And I was like, "Nah, this ain't going to the hole. This is going off to the right of the hole." So it wasn't going into the hole already done. And anyway, we cut the wire and we found a secondary device, which was designed to try and get the search team after we come in to investigate. And the device we found there is what they call a directional frag charge. So for those who don't know what a DFC is, it's essentially like you could say if you cut a gas bottle in half and fill it with explosives and then put like nuts and bolts and frag and stuff like that, it's designed to spray a large area rather than a focused explosion. So if we had had that detonated, it could have taken out three or four of our guys in one go, you know, as a secondary device. So they're very clever at what they do. But eventually we cleared that, got everything sorted. We ended up picking up James Steele. We had to recover his legs, his femurs, put them in bags. You know, that was quite, you know, gruesome because there's no humane way of doing it. You just got to pick it up and you throw it in a yellow plastic bag so nobody can see it. And it's just body parts and stuff like that. And then we found his rifle had been cut in half, and we found one half roughly about 70 meters away from the blast. So it was a bloody big blast. And then things like our search equipment, we have to take that back so they can't get any intelligence off us from the search equipment. So we picked everything up that we could. And then when we went back to the patrol base, which is only probably about 400 meters away, 400 or 500 meters away from the blast point. We went back there, and then our team was, you know, recalibrating all our kit, putting new batteries in, you know, like just getting all our admin squared away. And the the sergeant major of that infantry group called him over to announce that he died on the flight back. And the hard part about that was seeing like 30 grown men in tears, because it's like they've all lost their best mate. Do you know what I mean? So that was something that really used to get me a lot, like, you know, like all the time it used to get me thinking about that. And then that was like when we got back to our base, our patrol base that night, everyone's just like sitting in silence trying to like regather what, you know, what the fuck's just gone on, like, you know, and you're trying to sort of process it all. And it's a hard thing to process, like. And I think when you're on the ground picking up the body parts, dealing with the bombs, you're so pumped with adrenaline, you just feel normal. You don't feel that emotion coming in, stuff like that. So that was the one thing that got us. And then I don't know if you know what R&R is, like, have you served military?
Not military, no, just fire.
Oh, right, okay. So with the military, you probably know anyway, you get like R&R, which is like 2 week break in between somewhere in your deployment, and it can be a random point. But ours just so happened to be over Christmas, 2011. And we came back, so we went on R&R for 2 weeks, and we came back, I think it was like 2 or 3 days before New Year's Day, 2012. And we got back to Bastion, flew into Bastion from UK, and we slept in Bastion one night, and then we were flying out to our patrol base the next day. I can't remember what the base was called now, but basically we were flying out there the next day, which would have been New Year's Eve 2011 before 2012. And due to like jet lag and everything like that, we were asleep, like New Year's Eve, we were asleep in the tent, or like 8 of us were in the tent, flat out cold. We were just out for the count. So we weren't expected to do any jobs for a couple of days to just sort of get back into it. And then New Year's Day 2012, so obviously the next day now, we were in the command room, which is the main tent on the base, to get a briefing on the ground, what we're going to be covering, you know, the areas that we go, where the other teams are operating and stuff, you know, an idea about the ground itself. And they were saying, oh, we know you guys have been through a lot of stuff already. Like the team, even before I joined them, had gone through a lot of stuff, and then we just continued. They said, we know your team's been through a lot. We're one of the busiest teams on the ground. They said, but don't worry, this base has never had any contact. It's not been fired with anything, rockets, small arms fire from rifles, or anything, no fire whatsoever. And we were like, happy days, so it's going to be an easy ride here, then we thought. And literally an hour later, three mortars were fired at the base. And the first one, we'd looked at it where they'd all hit. The first one had hit our tent straight through the roof, and it just blew all our stuff to pieces. And it was like, if they were 24 hours earlier, that would have been a whole search team killed. So it's purely 24-hour window that, you know, they could have had us. And that's not traumatic at all. That was just like, Jesus Christ, that was lucky. You know, but then after, it just kind of gives you an idea of like the situations that can take place through tours. And then the thing that got me the most on tour, and I really struggled to tell this story for so long, but it was, we got called out to a job. And I think we were at PB4, Patrol Base 4, I think we were. And I can't remember what the job was. I think it was to clear a tree line or something. But we got called out on this job. And when you're going to a job, you're in single file. So you're trying to cover as little ground as possible, because if there's any devices, you don't want everyone spread out, type thing. So you go in single file, and I was the last man at the back. And we're going to this job. And bear in mind, you're doing, I won't say how many meters between each man, because it's obviously giving information away, but there's a certain distance between each man, which if somebody steps on a device, it dramatically reduces the impact of that blast based on how far away you are. So it tries to, you know, reduce the injuries between each soldier. But basically from the back to the front, it was a fair distance. Like I couldn't see the front man. And at the front, we had an officer, female doctor, like fully qualified officer, doctor. She'd been in, I don't know how many years, but she was a proper doc. And we all stopped in this field. And when you stop, you get down on one knee to get a bit lower on the ground, so in case you get contacted or anything like that. And where I stopped was right next to this little house, little mud, like not a mud house, but like a little hut, an Afghan home. And a family of three came out. So a dad and two kids. It was a little girl and a little boy. And they came out, and the little girl came up to me, obviously me being the closest. She came up to me and she was trying to talk to me. And I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't understand what she was saying. And in Afghan, a lot of the kids come up to you. They want sweets. They want pens, you know, something simple. And you think, oh, yeah, just get some sweets and chuck them to the kid. But I gave her some sweets and she was like that, like trying to tell me something. And I was like, I don't get it. What is it? And she lifted her sleeve up. She was only about four years old. And she lifted her sleeve up. And it was, seriously, it was septic from the wrist to the shoulder. Like, she was fucked. Do you know what I mean? She was going to die. If she didn't get medical attention at some point, she was not going to make it. And I radioed ahead. And I said, you know, we've got a doctor at the front. So I radioed ahead. I said, look, I've got a little girl here. She's in a bad way. We need some medical attention. They came back on the radio and said, leave her there. We've got a mission to do. Got a job to do. And that was the breaking point for me. I was like, I'm done with the army. You know, so, but the thing that got me recently was my daughter's now approaching that age. So it became like a daily reminder, you know, before I started hypnotherapy. And I was just like a daily reminder that we left that girl there. And for like 12 years, I just blamed myself. Should have done more. It was my decision. Do you know what I mean? So it was hard. That was the tipping point, like. Now, you think after all those situations that go on, like injured friends, recovering body parts, getting mortars in your tent, you'd think all that was the problem, but it wasn't. It was that little girl, you know. So that was the biggest impact.
It's interesting hearing you again underline that was the worst thing, because I mean, obviously there's a compounding element, you know, it's the death by a thousand cuts, all these things that you've been through up to this point. But I see this over and over and over again, that organizational betrayal. And it's not, in that case, deliberate. Like, if you see any sick kids, don't stop. But it's, you know, that kind of moral injury. Well, we were here to help these people. Here's a person we can tangibly help. And you're telling me no. And so, you know, internally, you're starting to deviate from that mission that you believe that you were serving when you first entered that particular, branch.
Yeah, well, the problem you get as well, when you go on deployment, there's this saying that gets thrown around all the time, hearts and minds. You've got to win hearts and minds. It's all about winning the people. And I'm like, if you leave a four-year-old girl to die like that, what's said that her dad now has probably got fucking Taliban contacts. Now you're a target because you let a little girl die, like. And I'm like, you ain't winning hearts and minds like that. And that, to me, I was like, it completely, my brain just couldn't process what had just been said. Now, I can blame that doctor as much as I want because it was her decision. But I also have to remember that she was probably 300 or 400 meters ahead and couldn't see this little girl. So she probably didn't understand the level of that injury. If I, like, this is why I blame myself for so long, because I should have been over the radio. It's septic. She's going to die. I could have been more and more and more on the radio. I'm not going until we do something about it, but I didn't. I was a private. She was an officer. She said no. I was like, look, we've got to go see her. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's kind of like that, like, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly it haunts you, and this is the thing, you know, I mean, when we have a mission, when we're part of a tribe and that's intact, it's very, very healing. And you look, you know, watch Restrepo and some of these documentaries, these guys are in, you know, crazy firefights and they're joking around with each other because they've got that shared suffering, that purpose, that tribe. When the tribe turns their back on you, or there's a deviation from that very mission that you thought you were supposed to be on. And, you know, as you said, that was momentary, you know, for that particular example. But to you, that was a true visceral opportunity to save a life, not just the hearts and minds, but to actually save a life. And as you said, that father now can be completely pro allies and, you know, down the road, feed information that saves, you know, our lives, you know, the British, the Americans and everyone else that was serving. But instead, we did the opposite. And so this, I guess, you know, not blaming, because I'm completely detached from this conversation, but when there's that moral compass shift that we have all sworn an oath to, whether it's in the first responders, whether it's in the military, that, as we said earlier, you know, divorce, you know, these are the soft areas that people tend not to notice are really, really detrimental when it comes to that. Because if that's everything you've sworn in, everything you believe in, and then that's betrayed in that moment, then it has you questioning everything.
Yeah, well, like I said, the problem is, like, recently, it was only about 8 weeks, probably a bit longer now, 10 weeks ago, like, the, well, 5 months, 5-6 months ago, the PTSD started coming back, and I had it under control for so long, like, years, I had it under control. It was still not healed, but it was, you know, every day was manageable, I wasn't snapping or anything like that, but yeah, like, 5 or 6 months ago, it all started coming back, and I was like, I just couldn't figure out why am I suddenly suffering again now, and it was like about 10 weeks ago, I looked at my daughter and I was like, fucking hell, like, you're nearly four, you're three now, you know, and you're like, that dad in Afghan hasn't seen his daughter grow up because she's probably not around anymore, you know, and I think that was the that was the reminder, the constant reminder, you know, but hypnotherapy now is really helping. Like, I've still got another 6 sessions to go through yet, but it's definitely made a hell of a difference. Like, I know it doesn't work for everybody, so I can't just, you know, say to your listeners, oh, go and get hypnotherapy. But for me, it's definitely made a big impact.
Beautiful. Yeah, I've heard even people talking about not only addressing some of the kind of the challenges that they've had, but also just from a performance level. Like, there's a hypnotherapist I had on the show, and she put me through, I think we did 2 or 3 sessions in the end, trying to help me with a book that I'm writing. And so it was less about going back in time and addressing things and more about kind of the manifestation of new things. So, you know, if people are skeptical, well, then enter it originally trying to be a better version of yourself. And you may find yourself going back in time and realizing that what's holding you back is actually some things that you never address.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we go forward from there now, so 2012 is when I decided to cut the army off, and then we got back from Afghan, and it wasn't like, for 3 months I was all right, I was fine, didn't know PTSD or anything, and I think I put that down to like still being pumped of adrenaline, and 3 months after I started to snap, and I was like, things weren't right, and I really struggled being out of the military at that point. Then I was probably 28 29. And I was like, man, I need to go back in. I've got to go back in the forces. I just needed to go back in. That was it. There was no other thing. But I was like approaching 30. I was like, do I want to be running around in a wet field with a Bergen on my back anymore? Do I want to go in the army anymore? I was like, I don't know. And then I thought, sod it, I'm going to go in the Navy. So that's when I signed up to the Navy. I trained my ass off for so long, for like 12 months or 18 months. I can't remember, 12 or 18 months. I was doing like half marathons, triathlons, like 13 fitness set. I was like going all out, and I even dropped down to a 2-day working week because I couldn't fit the sessions in. And I eventually joined as a mine clearance diver for the Navy, and I joined as a diver. And then you know, I think it's about 6 weeks on course. I got a, I can't remember how long on course I was, but I got an injury from I had a problem with my sinuses under the water. I couldn't deal with water pressure. So that caused me to get downgraded for diving, which also meant I couldn't do, my second job choice would have been a medic on the subs, submarines. But because of the pressure, well, I wasn't allowed to go on subs either. So I later went into the aviation side, the fleet air arm of the Navy, to become an aircraft handler. You know, the guys that do all the marshalling, the refueling, you know, the lorry driving and that sort of stuff. So just supporting the aircraft. I did that for a while, and then but because going from like diver, which is like full on fitness and intense day to day, to sitting around for 3 hours a day waiting for an aircraft to come back, it was like black and white, do you know what I mean? And I just, it wasn't for me. So I did about another six years there. And then I thought, I'm going to start coming out. And then when I started to talk about coming out, the guy that recruited me into the Navy, we're good friends as well, we stayed in touch. He heard I was coming out. He said, do you want to go into naval recruitment, which was like literally in my town, you know, so I could wear the uniform, have the structure, you know, go home every night, but still be military. And, you know, it was what's known as FTRS, so full-time reserves, but you're essentially just like Navy all the way through. But I was going out to schools, giving presentations, recruiting, psychometric testing and stuff like that. And that was good couple of years that was. I enjoyed it. It was a nice transition as well, where before I left the army, bomb disposal, straight into Civvy Street, and it was just like, pfft, like I just dropped off a cliff. But going into naval recruitment, I still had that little bit of attachment, so it kind of, it gave a much smoother transition out of the Navy. During the Navy time, I went through a bit of a spell in the Navy, and I was I came on, I had a couple of weeks just leave. I took leave for a couple of weeks. And during that, about 4 days into the first week, my granddad that lived next door, he had a heart attack, and my neighbour came running down. He said, "Oh, your granddad's on the floor. We can't pick him up. He's a big bloke, you know, real big bloke." And I run up there, and he was like face down. And I was like, you know, what the fuck's going on? So I grabbed him, pulled him over to try and like, you know, try and see what was going on. I couldn't get any air into his mouth because he'd smashed his mouth to pieces on the ground. So you couldn't breathe into him. So I just started chest compressions. I was like, fucking call an ambulance. And I was like trying to get on the phone to my dad. And at the time then, my PTSD was like, I was going overdrive at that point. And he died. He didn't make it. And after that, I went into a bit of a spiral. And my other granddad on my mum's side, he was an ex-Marine. And he had a brain tumour. We knew he wasn't going to make it. So he kind of expected the death at some point. When my other granddad had a heart attack, it was just sudden. One day he's here, the next day he's not. And about 5 weeks later, I got a call off my mum, said, "Oh, your granddad's in hospital, he's not going to make it." And this was like, fucking hell, would have been about probably 7-8 o'clock at night. I was like, fuck, I need to get home. So I phoned the petty officer who was in charge of me on the flight line. Said, "I've got to go home, my granddad's in hospital." So he's like, "Yeah, okay." So I drove up and I got to hospital 11 o'clock at night. And they said, "You can't come in because visiting hours are over." I said, "Look, I'm in the military. I've had to drive all the way up here. My granddad's probably not going to make it." And I went in there and he was unconscious, but like struggling to breathe. He had pneumonia as well, obviously went on his last couple of hours. And still breathing and that, but I went and saw him for half an hour. And then I left. I think I left about half 11, quarter to 12. And then he was pronounced dead at 12 o'clock. You know, so that was hard as well, like. You know, but after that, I went dark. You know, because obviously I had the PTSD, blown up wife. Tried to save one granddad, the other granddad died. It was just like constant, one after the other, you know. So, still gets me a little bit.
It should, though. I mean, this is the thing, you know. Healing is one thing, but I mean, it doesn't mean that you're not still going to have a flood of emotion when you think about people that you loved.
Yeah, but yeah, I ended up, that led to real, real deep depression. And the anxiety I got from that was insane. And I went into, doctors because I was having real bad chest pains. I thought it was a problem with my heart. And I went through about 3 months of like chest x-rays, heart, like ECGs, heart scans, and, you know, cameras down my throat and all sorts. Because every time the pain would come, my left arm would go numb as well. So like something's up with your heart. So I got downgraded again on base, and they took me off the flight line. And one day I went to doctors because I couldn't breathe. You know, I was really struggling to breathe, pain in my chest. And I went to doctors, said, "Oh, we can't fit you in now, but come back." This was like late in the afternoon anyway. So come back 8 o'clock in the morning for, you know, what do they call it? I can't remember what it's called now, but basically like it's fresh cases. They call it fresh cases. So you go to fresh cases in the morning. They deal with all the fresh patients. And I went in there, but walking up to the med center at the time, I was sweating. I couldn't breathe. My heart was, I thought I was going to fucking die, like, you know, and, I'd already had three months of like testing and scans and all this stuff. And I went in there and the doctor said, he said, "Oh yeah, just take your top off and I'm going to listen to your heart." I tried to lift it up and I just broke down in tears, like fucking real, you know, flood of emotion. Like, and he said, "It's not your heart, you got anxiety." I was like, fucking hell. You know, I didn't realize, like, you know, all them months had gone by. And then, they stuck me on antidepressants. And One of the things that didn't help me at the time, and I still get anxious now, is when I'm in loud environments. You know, like, it doesn't have to be like bangs and pops and door slamming, but like working with helicopters, it was just constant noise, and it used to stress me out really bad. Like, and I went on antidepressants for a while. I think it was for about fucking 9 months. maybe 9 months on antidepressants, and it made me feel like shit. Didn't work. Like, they might work for some people, but for me, they were not doing the job. And by this time then, I'd stopped sleeping, stopped eating right, put on weight. You know, I was a mess, you know, and I ended up, one day I just woke up and I was just like, I'm done feeling like this. I'm not doing it anymore. And that was the beginning into like meditation and stuff, you know. So the first thing was, I knew that if I couldn't, I knew that the PTSD had caused depression, which had caused anxiety. And the anxiety, at that point, it just becomes a spiral. It's a circle that feeds each other. You know, you get anxiety, you get more PTSD, you get more depressed, more anxiety, and just constant snowball. And I was like, fucking hell, first thing I've got to do is get the anxiety under control. That was the first thing I thought about, because if I could do that, I can start working on meditation for depression and go that route. So after making that decision, I started reading books. It wasn't like self-help books. The first book I went through, I didn't read it at the time. I hated reading. The first book I read was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And fuck me, that is a marathon of a book if you don't read. It's like small writing, about 350 pages, and took me bloody months to get through. You know, trying to do just 10 pages a night. And even then I struggled with it because I just couldn't bother reading. And I went online. I was like, what can I do for anxiety? And I found there's a company in UK called Calms, K-A-L-M-S. And they did a lavender capsule, a little capsule, gel capsule. You buy over a counter. There's no drugs in it. It's just pure lavender oil. And they said it can lower anxiety. So I thought, fuck it, what have I got to lose? Like, so I thought, I bought a load. You can't overdose on it. You know, it's lavender oil. It's a bloody plant. So I did that. When I got there, I double dosed. I just wanted to double dose on these and see how it goes. And literally within 3 hours, man, I was calm as hell. I was like, my anxiety dropped. I felt good. I was relaxed. I was all right. Now I know how to get rid of the anxiety or drop the anxiety. Now I need to work on the rest. So the next thing that was depressing then was obviously I put on weight. I didn't have any confidence going to the gym. So what I did then was, I understood like micro habits, like the military taught you micro habits. You know, if you do loads of little habits, eventually it becomes something bigger. And the first thing I wanted to do was get back in the gym, and I had no confidence. I was like, I ain't going in no gym. You know, I put weight on, I was out of shape, I couldn't do anything. So I thought, well, how can I at least start? And I thought the only way of me getting in the gym is by going at 4 a.m. when nobody's there. And that was the only way I was gonna get in there, because I knew if I was gonna go when it's busy, I ain't going in. So what I did for a little while, I got into the habit of just waking up at 4 a.m. and sitting in my room until I got consistent at that. And that's all I did, sit in my room. And then after that, and when I was consistent for 2 weeks of that, every day I could get up at 4 a.m. The next step then was, I'm going to go and sit outside the gym and just play on my phone at 4 a.m. Just play on my phone. I'm not doing anything. Just sit out there, 4 a.m., play on my phone. And then following that, then I'd go into the gym and just sit in the gym on my phone, not doing anything. It was empty, so it didn't matter. And then eventually I'd start doing 10 minutes on the cross trainer, you know, no impact, not really pushing it, just getting into the habit of being consistent again. And once I got onto the cross trainer, it was about 3 months, and I was like doing an hour and a half in the gym again, like it was nothing, didn't bother me. And I was happy to go when everyone else was going. My pull-ups had got good again, so you know, instead of being able to struggle to do one pull-up, I was doing 10 again. And you know, I got back into it quite quickly. So that's the micro habits, the only way I could get back in. And once I started the fitness, you know, I started to feel better mentally, and endorphins kicking in, and I was starting to lose weight, and then I was able to sleep again. And that's kind of how I pulled myself out of that hole. But Jesus Christ, dude, it was a long journey that was to get out of that habit of not doing anything, you know. So I'd got rid of I'd lowered the anxiety with the capsules, and eventually got into the gym again, you know. So, and then from there, then I just started to work on the mindset, really. And that's where I fixed it for so long, you know. I was all right for years, like I said, until the daughter issue came along, you know. But yeah, and then it was, yeah, that's kind of it. But I know I rewound there, but obviously I went into military recruitment after that and did that, and then came into, after military recruitment, I went into defense recruitment for BAE Systems, who manufactured the, you know, the military ships and submarines and aircraft. Did that for 12 months, and then eventually, like I said, 15 years, I decided to finally take the leap into graphic design. you know, and that was January 2022. I thought it's time to do something with it, you know. So I started learning Adobe and all on YouTube, self-taught, and that's where I'm at now, you know. So
talk to me about that. What is it that you do in the graphic design world now?
So at the moment, we specialize in building LinkedIn profiles for business owners and content creators. So obviously the design element comes into like the banner, the photo, featured section, thumbnails. My girlfriend's a copywriter, so she manages all the copy, you know, about sections, headlines. We do all the SEO for searchability as well, like, you know, so that's what we do at the minute. That's all we specialize in.
So what about, you said, you know, things were going well until obviously you were kind of getting these flashbacks again with your little girl being about the same age as the girl in Afghanistan. I mean, what a beautiful kind of journey you've led us through as far as the micro habits and how you got from, I don't want to do anything at all, just to go to, I'm going to wake up at the time that ultimately I'm going to go to the gym. I thought that was genius because, you know, it's a big leap to go from, you know, complete inertia to I'm going to do a 90-minute workout. So you've developed these habits. You mentioned meditation as well. What did you lean into again after that 6 months where it kind of had that resurgence?
So I still continued the meditation and I laid off the lavender capsules for a little while and I just kept a box on me all the time because if it ever started to, you know, you can tell when anxiety's coming because you start to get shortness of breath and, you know, I'd get the, like people can be anxious and not have anxiety. Like when you have real anxiety, it is like paralyzing. Like people don't realize, they think, oh yeah, I've got anxiety. It's like, you ain't got anxiety until you're like almost hitting the floor thinking you're having a heart attack. Do you know what I mean? You know, and so I always used to keep some on me at the time. And yeah, like obviously I'd go back to work, start getting back into, you know, the PT and stuff like, you know, with the squad. You know, we did a few bits on ships and stuff like that. But it got to a point where I realized that the noise of the helicopters was triggering me again. And I was just like, I can't do this job anymore. And I couldn't transition to another job. Because the only other one would have been medic on the subs, and I couldn't do that job, you know. So that's when I decided to leave, you know, and it was just purely just fitness. But when I left training, recruitment, naval recruitment, I was still in naval recruitment at the time. I kind of fell into that recluse sort of mindset again. I kind of went back in my shell a little bit and I stopped doing fitness and I was like, man, I've got to sort this out again. I was living back with my dad. I moved back in, you know, with my dad. And I was like, man, I've got to start meeting people again. Like, you know, I just threw myself out there and I was like, right, there's a CrossFit gym down the road. Meet people in the CrossFit gym. I need to get fit again. And I knew that if I was going to go to CrossFit, I was going to die. Do you know what I mean? The fitness, because I'd lost my fitness again. So I thought, right, for 6 weeks, I'm just going to run. I'm going to do 5 miles a day, run every day. You know, I started doing that, just started doing 5 miles off the bat. I struggled to do 5 miles at a time, but I just made sure I did 5 miles a day, 25 miles a week, even if I had to walk some of it. And I was just like, did 6 weeks of that. I was like, right, I'm ready to go CrossFit. I went to CrossFit, started doing that, got absolutely beasted, enjoyed it, met my girlfriend, we had the kid. That's where I met her at the gym, you know, so we had something in common then, you know. So, fitness really helps, you know, it's good. I should meditate more than I do. I know meditation helps a lot, but I need to put more effort into that. But I just haven't bloody got time. We do the business. I've got the YouTube. I've got the little one waking me up at stupid o'clock and, you know, kind of 5 minutes.
It's a lot. What do you use as far as meditation? Do you use an app?
Zen music on YouTube. There's some really good tracks on YouTube, actually. Yeah, and I've just had sound bathing meditation suggested to me with the what they call them, the bowls, the,
oh yeah, the prayer bowls,
yeah, the things that they tap, like, you know, and yeah, it's quite nice to listen to. But yeah, the Zen stuff really puts me in deep.
Beautiful. Because the reason I ask, I use Headspace, and that one, I mean, they have as little as, you know, a minute meditation. So on those micro steps, again, that's kind of a good one because it's guided. So you've got a voice kind of talking to you, and they'll, you know, the longer the meditation, the more time there is with no speech, because now you've had time to be eased in and they just kind of let you focus on your breathing. But that's a very good baby steps app to get you back into meditation.
Yeah, like if anybody's not done meditation before, I've heard loads of people say, oh yeah, I've tried it, it doesn't work. the problem with meditation, and you'll know this if you meditate, is when you first start, a minute feels like an hour. It's like, Jesus Christ, I've only been in a minute trying to meditate. I can't sit still that long. But eventually, after 4, 5, 6 weeks or a couple of months, an hour feels like a couple of minutes. You know, Jesus Christ, an hour has passed. And you're like, your energy levels are just through the roof. Like, you know, when I was getting into meditation, even in that dark situation back in the Navy, I got so heavy into meditation, I could feel my body buzzing all the time. Like I was just, even when I was depressed, I was just like energetic, like, you know, amazing. But yeah, I used to go so deep into meditation. The only way I'd come out of it is I knew I'd stop breathing because I'd gone so far in. And I'd come around, my mouth had been wide open and it was dry. And I was like, I knew I'd stop breathing. I don't know how long, it might have been just a couple of seconds, but I'd come around like, Jesus Christ, and then I'd be buzzing, but then I'd be starving because I'd burnt so much energy in meditation, you know. And I was like, man, this is amazing. It was addictive, you know. So when you get into it properly, like all these monks and that, they must love life, just meditating all the time, like. And the Buddhas and that, yeah.
I want to hit one more area and then we'll go to some closing questions. But when I talk to people about time in combat, there's two areas that we don't normally hear. And you organically led us through one, which was, you know, regardless of the politics that put you in a place, you know, what was some of the horrible people that you encountered? And obviously these people in this case were trying to murder you and your friends. So it's pretty clear. But the other thing that we don't really hear on our news very much is kindness and compassion, which is something that you tried to do at that moment with that little four-year-old. Through your whole time in uniform, what were some of the kind of memories when it came to kindness and compassion, even if you were in, you know, a combat heavy area?
So not necessarily on deployment, but like when we went on like to Oman for training, we'd meet a lot of like people who live in Oman. You know, you're mixing with the locals, you're sharing the culture, you know, and helping them out. And it's an amazing, like people, if you haven't been to Oman, it's an amazing country, like, and it's crazy, right? So I'll just quickly tell you a little bit about Oman. But there's several times throughout the day where they pray, and they pray in a certain direction. And you'll see the roads, the bypasses, the motorways, everything comes to a stop. Everybody gets out the vehicles, they go to the roundabouts because the roundabouts are massive, like shrines almost. And they all get on the roundabouts and outside the vehicles, put their mat on the floor, they do their prayer, and they all get back in the vehicle as if it never happened and just crack on with the day. And it's like, this place is nuts. The only thing is, so good to watch their culture, and their food is amazing. And like we had a, you know, cutthroat shaves with the proper shaves, and they do head massages and just getting really into cultures. I love it. I love meeting other cultures. But yeah, that's like kind of a little bit of a culture connection. But the compassion stuff, obviously the little girl tried to help. You know, like another thing we did, I can't remember what year it was. I think it was 2009. There was a flood in the Lake District, or a bridge collapsed in the Lake District. And we had to go out and put a temporary bridge in as engineers. That's what we do. And all the locals were loving it, you know, bringing out cups of coffee and mixing with the locals, and you're helping them out because the bridge is collapsed and now you got to put a temporary bridge in and people can't get across and all that sort of stuff. So like flood help and things like, you know, Florida getting hit with hurricanes and you've got to go and give, you know, humanitarian assistance there. And the military do a lot of good stuff. They do. But there's just some things that happen in the very finer details that affect people in you know, quite an impactful way.
I think it's important that we hear the good that the military does, because I mean, you know, when you think about a two-dimensional perception of the military, it's like, oh, they go and kill people, you know. But obviously it's far more nuanced than that, you know. And it's, you know, there's times where the wrong people are killed, you know. That collateral damage is a very kind of harsh term for human lives lost that shouldn't have been lost. And you know, Gaza is a prime example of that now. But it's important that we highlight the good, because I've heard so many amazing stories of, you know, kindness, compassion, community, inclusion, you know, in these places. Because I think one of the things that the US media does very poorly is they kind of just tar an entire nation with the same brush. So right now, supposedly, all Russians want to be in Ukraine. I doubt highly all Russians want to be in Ukraine, you know what I mean? And it's the same with, you hear these Afghan and Iraqi indigenous people that, you know, literally risk their lives alongside the allies to protect their country.
Well, the thing is as well, mate, so like one of the biggest things that the Navy do is humanitarian assistance. That is like one of their biggest, if not the biggest operation they do. Like they go around the world all the time and like policing the sea for drug imports trying to get in. You know, they stop drugs coming in, weapons coming in. They're policing like the Navy have got such an insane job to do. Like it's mental. If you could see what the Navy do, it's nuts, right? But humanitarian, you know, Florida gets hit with a hurricane. What they do, they just, right, one of the ships on training exercise, right, that's re-rolled now to go and give humanitarian assistance. Supplies, equipment, you know, Royal Marines, right? People see them as killing machines. They're out there doing, you know, construction work and building huts and shelters and, you know, making sure people have got medical supplies and food and, you know, so it's easy for people to say, oh yeah, you get brainwashed in the military and it's all about killing. It's like, no, it's bullshit. Like, you know, most of the deployment, like our deployment, we were there to find bombs. We weren't there for fire support. You know, a lot of the teams, a lot of search teams on the ground don't even fire one bullet during their entire deployment because the infantry take care of that. You know what I mean? So they're just there to clear routes so that the public can get down that route again, or they can go into their compound again, or, you know, getting rid of Taliban in a certain area so the people have got freedom of movement again because they're being restricted in a certain area, you know. So people need to be very careful how they tar the military. Like, don't get me wrong, people come out of the military a lot of the time battered, mentally and physically, a lot of the time, you know, especially if you've been to, like, operational deployment. But the stuff the military can do is phenomenal. It's phenomenal, like, and it's such a big, big organization. I know some people listen to this and go, yeah, but they're used for, you know, control the public and they're used for terrorism and, you know, they've got licenses to kill. And no, that's it. You know, most of the guys that join want to go there to do some good. That's what most people want to do. You get the occasional nutter, you know, nutcase that wants to go, I just want to go and kill everyone because they're just crazy. You know, but even them people, it gets battered out of them. It gets beaten out of you in training. If you're an arsehole going into training, you're going to come out the other side as a different person. Like, you will.
Beautiful. Well, one more thing just before we transition. You have kind of walked us through, you know, the challenges that you had, the tools that you found to apply to yourself. What about the tools that were given you in the preparation to transition? Again, this isn't pointing fingers. It's a conversation that comes up a lot. That transition from, you know, especially if you were, you know, in some sort of combat unit, and then, as you mentioned, the next thing you're back in, you know, the shopping center back in England, that can be very jarring for some people. You know, you've lost your kind of identity in a way. You've lost your sense of purpose. You've lost your tribe that you literally would die for. What were the tools that were given to you, and if there are areas, how would you advise them to be improved for this next generation of warfighters?
So coming out of the military is a very hard one to manage, because especially if you come off deployment, you don't normally start to see the PTSD until a couple of months later. You know, you go through like a 24-hour period in Cyprus, what they call decompression, where there's no rifles, there's no shooting, you just get to have a beer, have a laugh. And they assess everyone, but it's like you've literally just come out of Afghan on a plane to Cyprus, have a beer, and now you're going to UK. That decompression area is not long enough to assess anybody. It's just not. Do you know what I mean? Because, like I said, my PTSD didn't start to come in until 3 months after. You know, so it's hard to. I think it's almost impossible for the military to manage that, because unless you're going to put somebody in holdover, which is tens of thousands of troops. At any one point, you know, across the military, RAF, Navy and Army, tens of thousands of serving personnel at any one point could be out of service for 3 to 6 months while you're assessing them. So they're not going to be able to do that. In terms of PTSD help, I know it's becoming more and more aware now and it's being looked into. I know they're testing psychedelics in military at the moment, and they're also testing, when I was leaving, they were testing meditation. That was coming in, so there was meditation being tested, and I know some of the processes and hypnotherapy as well, some of the processes that they've done, people who have been suffering for over 10 years have been almost fully recovered within 6 months. So they're trying, but it's a big, big problem. And I think it's too big for anybody. Like, you do stuff with, you know, with people with mental health. I'm trying to do the YouTube. I've got, you know, charities in UK. There's Help for Heroes. And I think the problem is, it's such a massive, massive problem that even with all these people trying to help, we're not even scratching the surface. We're not. I mean, you could go 10x the people that are trying to help, and we still wouldn't be scratching the surface, because it's such a big problem, you know. And especially, like, I focus on men with my one, because we don't talk, and that's why I focus on men, you know. So I think that's the problem. But the transition in terms of leaving from military to civilian, you've got resettlement, you can do courses, you've got, you know, some funding to go and get qualifications as you transition out. A lot of the younger lads who do 4 years, they can't be bothered with resettlement. They just want to get out, and then they leave with nothing. A lot of the guys who've done 20 years, 25 years or whatever, they tend to take their time and plan a bit better when they come out, and they use the resources that they've got.
So you mentioned a YouTube channel. Talk to me about what you're doing to be part of the solution when it comes to the mental health crisis.
Right. So obviously when I had the breakdown, about 8 or 9 weeks ago, I've got quite a big following on LinkedIn for profiles, and I went into such a spin that I wasn't replying to DMs, comments, anything like that. I wasn't doing it, and people could tell that, you know, they couldn't tell something was going on, but they knew something was out of normal, like abnormalities that were going on, because my content wasn't regular. And but I just came out one day, I was like, listen, you ain't going to expect this video, but this is what's going on. I was like, I'm in a bad way. And I talked about my struggles and PTSD and what had gone on deployment in the video, just came out public. And within 10 minutes of that video, I had like 9 other guys in my DMs going, how the fuck did you come out public with that? Because they're struggling, and they haven't got the confidence to talk about it. I was like, man, this is a big problem. And at the same time, I had a couple of therapists reach out as well, offering me free support, you know, to try like psychedelics, EMDR, hypnotherapy. I had a few, and I passed a couple of them forward, but I'm going with the hypnotherapy. And I realized that men don't talk, and this was the sparking point of what I do now. So I started the YouTube channel. Initially, I've started off with speaking to any men who have faced trauma and now suffer with PTSD and depression. Even if they're through the other side, I want to know their story, how they got through it, you know, the treatment they used, or whatever, you know, whatever the story be. To get their stories shared, because I want people to start talking. And I know since doing the 2 interviews, I've only got 2 interviews on there at the moment speaking about trauma. But since then, I've had other men come out and say, oh, we'd be interested in telling our story. It's giving people confidence to talk. And although I'm not qualified in any treatment or medication or anything like that, the idea eventually, you know, once I get a good network, will be to interview the men to get the stories, but connect them to the right therapists who can help, and charities and stuff like that. And eventually I'll register later on down the road. I'll register to become a charity myself. But the idea with my channel now, at the minute, cause I'm on a budget, I'm just doing like Zoom interviews, you know, to get the stories out there, just to start recording. But if you go on the YouTube channel, you'll be able to find, but I've got a GoFundMe. I'm trying to raise funds through the business and through GoFundMe to buy a vehicle which I can turn into a mobile podcast station, and then I'm going to drive around the UK and I'm going to go and interview these people face to face. That's the goal, like, so yeah.
Beautiful. So where can people find the YouTube channel, and where can they find the link for the GoFundMe? I'll put it on my webpage as well, but where else are people listening?
Yeah, so the YouTube channel's Decision of Power, youtube.com, however they spell it, /, and it's decision_of_power, decision of power with underscore on each, underneath each one. If you're trying to find me on TikTok, on Instagram, it's just Decision of Power, all one word, no underscores. And if you go on any of those socials, there's a link to the GoFundMe as well. So I've got quite a big target of 65K. It is a big target, and I know that, but there's a lot I need to do in that vehicle. It won't just be a little van. It'll be a full massive vehicle, sleeping quarters, you know, podcast studio, kit the front out as well for podcasts as well, so we can do it whilst traveling, grab a coffee, have a chat. Yeah, it's going to be a full 360 job on the whole truck, like, you know. So, and then some of it will go to fund things like, you know, 12 months worth of fuel, insurance, you know, the equipment to record. You know, so I'm trying to get as much of the funds together to get everything covered as I can.
Brilliant. Well, Darren, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, for walking us through, you know, your journey. And again, I think there's just as much power in, you know, the divorced parents and the girl that you couldn't save as some, you know, some of the grotesque things that you also witnessed. But the fact that those two were more traumatic, ultimately, I think, you know, really does underline the fact, as we said before, that you can't compare trauma. And, you know, that moral injury piece is a very, very real thing, whether you're a young kid with divorced parents or whether you're trying to save a young child. So I want to thank you so much, not only for your courageous vulnerability today, but also for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.